Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn, and thanks for joining us for Pod 41. Follow that car. Tonight, we're on the case in Greeley, Colorado, about 60 miles north of Denver. The city, known for its popular 4th of July stampede, became the backdrop for a dark mystery when the body of Randy Baker was found sprawled out in his own home. The investigation into his death would reveal a stunning series of betrayals of a man who dedicated his life to helping others. August 16th, 2017. It was 8:30 in the morning when Greeley police received a heartbreaking call for help.
I just got home and I opened the door and my husband's dead on the floor.
The woman on the line, Kelly Baker, had just found her 59-year-old husband, Randy, lying motionless.
Do you think he is beyond any help?
I don't know. I can't do it. I can't look.
Greeley police rushed to the scene. Detective Doug Medhurst was one of the first to arrive.
When I got to the Baker home, Kelly Baker was sitting out at the front steps of the house that lead to the front door, waiting for my arrival.
Emergency crews also came, but it was already too late.
Randy was obviously deceased. There is a door that leads from the garage to the house, and just inside of this door, he was laying kind of face down on his right side. There was some blood around his head.
Kelly Baker was distraught. She said that her husband had recently undergone heart surgery. And she had a theory about what may have caused his death.
Randy had a pacemaker, so she felt that Randy had collapsed and fallen there. It certainly looked possible that Randy could have just collapsed due to health issues.
First responders on the scene agreed. Detective Michael Prill.
Our preliminary determination was he likely had a heart attack.
The evidence added weight to the theory. It appeared that Randy had just walked into the house before he fell. His cell phone was found next to his body.
Laying near his body was a bag of food from a local restaurant, along with a large cup of soda. The soda had poured out of the cup when Randy dropped the bag.
Kelly told police it was possible her husband's accident had taken place after he arrived home from work the day before. She said she had spent the night at a friend's house. But as investigators searched the home, they immediately noticed something odd.
There was a door leading from the kitchen area out to the backyard, and it was ajar. There was also a gate in the backyard that was open.
Police focused on getting basic information about the victim. Kelly told officers that Randy was a drug counselor who worked with felons trying to overcome their addictions. He would usually drive himself to and from the rehab center, but she had noticed his car was missing.
She told me that there was a Pontiac G6 sedan that they owned that's normally in the garage, and that wasn't there. And she said Randy generally left his wallet in the car as well, and that was missing.
It didn't make sense. Detectives searched the entire house, but nothing else seemed to have been taken.
There was nothing missing. The car was the big concern. I contacted coworkers of Randy's as well as his supervisor if he left his car at work and had gotten a ride home, and they said no.
The missing car, the open back door and gate, led investigators to change gears They began to consider the possibility that Randy had not died from heart failure.
Where could his car be if he had a heart attack when he stepped into his home?
Police hoped other members of Randy's family might know more. Kelly reached out to Randy's daughter from a previous marriage. Randy's daughter, Betty Weinick.
I was at work Wednesday morning, and my husband was there as well. I kept seeing Kelly's phone number on the work phone, so I told him to grab it, and I could tell it was bad. And so we drove right over to my dad's house that morning.
Kelly also called Randy's sister, Carol.
All three of them appeared distraught. They kind of encircled one another to seek support from one another.
For Randy's daughter, Betty, those moments remain a painful blur.
Kelly was on the driveway waiting for me, and I went to her and just started crying. I pretty much crumbled in her embrace.
Betty was also aware of her father's heart condition.
He had an enlarged heart from being electrocuted. An enlarged heart would mean he was very lethargic all the time, pretty sick, would sleep a lot more, would have a lot of hospital stays and doctor visits and a lot of medications.
Like Randy's wife, Kelly also believed that her dad's heart issue was most likely what had killed him.
All three of them supported the belief that Randy could have died from a medical condition.
But all of that changed when the medical examiner took a closer look at Randy's body. He discovered shocking new information. It turned out the 59-year-old had been shot to death.
I sat down and just sobbed. I was just blown away.
The position in which Randy had fallen had concealed the true nature of his injuries.
He died as a result of two bullet wounds that they'd found that were not visible when I'd been on scene.
It was an incredible turn of events. The wound suggested how the crime unfolded.
He was shot behind the left ear and in the left shoulder. A logical theory was that someone was laying in wait just inside the door he came through and likely fired from a close distance and shot him in one of those two places and then essentially a coup de grace in the other place.
And there was another shocking revelation. The bullets had come from two different guns. Investigators believed it was possible that two people might have been responsible for Randy's murder.
That's the common line of thinking. It's uncommon for an individual to be carrying two handguns and use both handguns. So the evidence at least indicates that two guns were used, and more often than not, that would indicate two people were involved.
Randy Baker's death had just become a homicide investigation. Detectives shifted into high gear.
He was murdered. We were behind the curve, and so there was a lot of scrambling.
Investigators had to quickly reevaluate all the evidence and race to catch up with a cold-blooded killer or killers who were now on the loose. For loved ones, losing Randy was a crushing blow. But trying to understand why somebody would kill him was even more difficult.
It was devastating.
He had everything to live for, and he adored being a father to Betty. Randy's ex-wife, Dori Baker.
He loved Betty. He loved holding her, being with her. He, as a man, you know, Randy wasn't perfect or anything, but his love and devotion were always visible.
Betty idolized her dad. Growing up, he was always the last one to speak with her before she went to bed. It became part of their nightly routine.
He would make sure I called every single night, and we even came up with like a good night saying. And it was, good night, sweet dream, sleep tight, don't let the bed bugs bite. That's right, I love you with all my might, you're dynamite, you're out of sight. If anyone says anything different, they're gonna have a big old fight. Let your light shine bright, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. That's right, 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 can't wait, 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 because you're great, great, great.
Not only was he a caring father, but he dedicated his life to helping others. As a drug counselor, Randy had guided many people through their darkest hours.
He was amazing because of his honesty, his sincerity, helping people, lifting them up, and helping them find a new life.
In absolutely every single person, he believed that there was some real light in people and that you just needed to find it and help them see it in themselves. That's the essence of who my father was.
Randy was a big man whose generosity of spirit often made him seem larger than life.
He was huge, 6'4", like 250, 260, and bald, so a little bit more intimidating too. He went to every homecoming dance with me in high school. He was a chaperone. A lot of the boys would be like, I am never talking to you because your dad is so scary.
Betty had watched her father move on with his life after his divorce from her mother. And just before his death, he had showed far more resilience as his second marriage crumbled.
Kelly and my father had separated. Kelly left.
Randy had come to terms with separating from his second wife, Kelly, who still ran her hair salon from the basement of their home.
He said he was starting to be happy with how his life was turning out.
Police asked Kelly about the separation. She said things between them were amicable, even though she had moved out.
She portrayed the breakup as amicable and that they were proceeding towards a divorce.
That's why Kelly hadn't been home on the night of the murder. She told police she had been staying at a friend's home, 17 miles away. Detectives set out to verify her alibi.
We were able to show that Kelly arrived at that home shortly after 6 in the evening on the 15th of August and remained until 7-ish in the morning on the 16th.
Kelly's alibi looked even more solid as detectives continued to narrow the window of time in which the murder had taken place. It turned out that Randy hadn't even left work until close to 6 p.m. that evening.
Randy had been at work at the halfway house, which is located about an hour away, so it would take him at least an hour to get back to Greeley.
And it appeared Randy had made at least one stop on his way home from work. The crime scene indicated he had picked up dinner.
That bag of fast food and the drink cup were labeled for Santiago's. In Greeley, we have only one location. So I was able to contact the owner and review her video surveillance.
Detective Medhurst's due diligence paid off when he spotted Randy's car.
Randy was seen on video surveillance at 7:30 going through the drive-thru. I see a silver Pontiac G6 sedan. The owner provided me the receipt for the purchase, and it matched what Randy had with him when he was discovered in his house, deceased.
The surveillance tape provided a key detail for the investigation team.
It proved that he was alone. Common sense would dictate that the drive from the restaurant to the house puts him at the house about 7:35 p.m. And we found him as if he just walked into the house from parking his car.
The attack on Randy Baker looked to have been a carefully planned ambush. That led police to wonder who would have known he would be arriving home at that time. Investigators immediately considered the possibility that he had been targeted by one of the men he counseled for their drug addiction.
It could have been someone from the ATC where Randy worked. It is a halfway house for convicted felons.
And that meant any one of them was a potential suspect. On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. Assistant DA Rob Miller.
Everyone he worked with did have some sort of criminal history.
Detective Michael Prill.
They felt it possible that Randy, in his role as a drug and alcohol counselor, angered one of them to the point that they may have followed him home and killed him.
Randy's sister Carol added weight to the theory. She had remembered something about her visit to Randy's house shortly before he got home.
She said she got there about 6:30 in the evening, was there for roughly 15 minutes. She said she drew the blinds, shut the doors, locked up the family dog before leaving.
Carol said as she left that night, she noticed someone who seemed out of place walking around the neighborhood.
She mentioned that she saw a nefarious-looking male walking in the neighborhood.
Could that man that she had seen have been Randy Baker's killer? Investigators tried to chase down the lead, but it didn't get them very far.
We spoke with a lot of neighbors, but she gave us little information about this individual other than she saw him lurking in the neighborhood when she was leaving.
Still, the tip about a suspicious man lurking around the house on foot seemed promising. It lined up with the fact that Randy's car had been stolen, and the Pontiac was still nowhere to be found. Officer Doug Medhurst.
Randy's car was missing, and I could not account for it. I could not find it. Every lead I followed up at that point was coming up to a dead end.
Detectives knew that finding Randy's car was critical to their case.
I felt that was very critical. Quite possibly this had been a robbery or a burglary that had been interrupted by Randy. I felt his car was going to contain crucial evidence.
But investigators worried that tracking down this particular car would be like finding a needle in a haystack.
It was an old enough car that it didn't have, you know, GPS equipment within it. So an alert was put out through the press asking for anyone with information on the vehicle, if they've seen it, if they know where it's at, to let us know.
5 days later, they caught the break they were hoping for. Someone called in and said they found an abandoned car matching the description of the car police had been searching for.
Neighbors in the college area of Greeley called in to report a suspicious vehicle parked in the alley.
The silver Pontiac was unlocked, and it appeared it had been stolen.
License plates were removed. The keys were left on the floorboard of the driver's side.
A routine check of the car led to a critical discovery.
The vehicle identification number was run through the national computers and came back to Randy Baker.
Homicide investigators raced to the neighborhood, just 4 miles from Randy Baker's home.
So now we're hoping perhaps DNA or fingerprints were left in the vehicle, or witnesses saw the vehicle get dropped off.
Crime scene technicians carefully processed the car. They quickly learned that whoever had left Randy's car in the alley did a thorough job of cleaning it first.
The wiping and the cleaning is the type of thing someone would do with any experience, as opposed to, say, a kid took it or someone just took the car because it was running and warming up. So whoever took it, it had some experience as a criminal with stolen equipment.
When technicians called with the result, detectives were disappointed.
No evidence that helped us with the investigation was found in or on the vehicle.
And a neighborhood campus also came up empty.
No witnesses saw the vehicle dropped off. We really had no new lead to take us in the next direction.
It's kind of a dead end.
But as word spread about Randy Baker's car being found, a tip from an unlikely source came in.
Within a day or two of recovering the car, an inmate at our jail reached out and indicated he had some familiarity with Randy's car.
The informant told investigators a shocking story.
The guy said someone was trying to sell me that car involved in a murder.
Detectives were skeptical and pressed the informant for more details.
This individual indicated the vehicle had been posted through social media for sale. He directed us to this advertisement that was within that social media account. And just in looking at the image of the vehicle, it seemed to match Randy's car in every way.
The date of the post was just 4 days after Randy's murder.
It kind of established who had the car and when, or at least began to hammer out a timeline for the car.
The social media account attempting to sell the car was connected to Santita Bashan and her roommate Mike. Both of their names were very familiar to police.
Individuals that are constantly on our radar for one thing or another.
Investigators brought Santita in for a series of videotaped interviews about Randy Baker's car.
We need to hear where you got it.
My roommate showed up with the car. He said he bought it.
Police then asked about the post on her social media account.
Why did you try to sell this car off?
I didn't try selling it.
You just happened to ride around in a car that was stolen from a victim in a homicide. Continuing to lie about this is going to wrap you up in it.
I didn't know about a murder.
Police turned up the pressure, but Santita stuck to her story.
She said she had no idea it was stolen.
Santita claimed her roommate got rid of the car when he realized it was evidence in a homicide investigation.
You and Ann went and dumped the car?
No.
Washed it off and everything?
No, I was not there when that happened. I don't know anyone that I know. That's it.
Investigators were convinced Santita was lying. They believed she was there when the car was dumped.
Santita and Mike saw the newspaper article detailing the importance of this missing Pontiac, realized they're driving a dead man's car, realized the implications that could mean for them, and so the two of them dumped the vehicle off where we found it and washed it off.
And if she was lying about her part in cleaning and abandoning the car, detectives wondered what else she was hiding. They believe she either played a role in Randy's murder or knew who did. Detectives decided to press her for answers.
Under arrest, she and charged you with accessory to first-degree murder.
Are you serious?
Oh, but for sure.
I've already told you I had no idea, sir.
The threat of being charged with a serious felony worked. Santita finally came clean and told police she had actually been given the car by her boyfriend, Mark.
And Mark had something to do with the murder?
No.
How did the car get into Mark's possession?
I have no idea.
Police then asked Santita for her boyfriend's full name. They were stunned when she said it was Mark Raisley. Mark was someone extremely close to the victim.
Randy Baker's nephew.
Randy Baker's homicide investigation suddenly had its first solid suspect.
The nephew was in possession of Randy's car.
Investigators had a lot of questions for Mark.
Why do you have Randy's vehicle? How did you get Randy's vehicle? Did you murder Randy?
More on The Case, the podcast, after this. Old Mark Raisley had a history of drug abuse, and investigators wondered if his addictions could have made him desperate enough to kill his uncle. Detective Michael Prill.
He was in and out of prison, always in trouble.
Detectives brought Raisley to police headquarters for questioning.
I'm trying to determine how Randy was murdered and by whom. Having him explain how he came into possession of the vehicle. I want to know if Mark was involved in any way with the murder of Randy Baker.
The videotaped interrogation of Mark Raisley quickly became intense.
Did you murder your uncle?
No. But he on a lot of different levels. But I ain't a murderer.
So you did not murder your uncle?
No.
Who did?
I don't even know, man. Like,
something tells me you do.
As the interview progressed, Mark Raisley seemed to realize just how much trouble he was in. And the possibility of life in prison led him to tell police the chilling story of how he wound up with his uncle's Pontiac. It was a shocking account that put more of Randy's family into the crosshairs of the investigation. In particular, Randy's sister, Carol Baker.
Mark said on the evening of the 15th of August, Carol met him and handed over a set of keys for the Pontiac and told him to take it to a chop shop or to burn the vehicle.
Investigators were stunned. Even by her own account, Carol Baker had been at Randy's home just a few hours before his murder.
Did she tell you what she meant by getting rid of it?
No, I was like, is it hot? She said no.
Despite his concerns, Mark ultimately agreed to do what his Aunt Carol had asked.
And Mark drove off in the Pontiac, ultimately giving the Pontiac to Santita.
Mark claimed he had no idea the car belonged to his uncle. Now investigators weren't sure what to believe.
Well, it piqued my interest for sure. Now Carol Baker, the last person known to be in Randy's house the night he was murdered, is handing off the keys to his car to her nephew.
So why is your aunt signing off a dead man's car? Her own brother, for crying out loud. Why would she set you up in a murder?
She just said, get rid of it. Let's bring her
in. We plan to. Right now we're talking to you.
The more Mark insisted that his aunt was somehow involved, the more investigators started to feel that he was actually telling the truth.
From a common sense perspective, why would he lie? He's identifying a 68-year-old female with no criminal past. He knows I'm going to ask her.
When police pressed Mark Raisley, he dropped another bombshell. His Aunt Carol had told him that she had originally been given the car by another member of his family, her son, Kelly. The new revelation raised even more red flags.
Well, I'm beginning to wonder how Carol Baker might be involved in this murder and how her son, Kelly Raisley, is involved in this murder.
Police quickly discovered that Kelly Raisley's criminal past was much more sinister than his cousin Mark's.
Kelly Raisley, a career criminal and a member of a ultra-violent gang in Colorado, is now apparently in contact with the Pontiac before Carol gives it over to Mark.
The Randy Baker murder had become an extremely complicated case for everyone working on it. Officer Doug Medhurst.
I have never seen a case like this. This is easily the most complex and twisted murder I've ever had a part in all my years.
Police were now convinced that Randy's sister Carol and nephew Kelly were somehow involved in his murder. They set their sights on talking with the 68-year-old mother first. Carol willingly came in for questioning. Detectives asked her for an alibi for the night of her brother's murder.
She was staying a mile or two away from the Baker home, caring for her invalid aunts.
During the questioning, Carol failed to mention anything about Randy's car or where it had gone.
She never provided any information about Randy's car to us.
Police believe she had played a role in getting rid of Randy's car after the murder, but had no idea why. Still, Carol's withholding of critical information led police to do a deep dive into her cell phone records. What they discovered was a revelation. Carol and Randy's estranged wife were much closer than anyone knew.
On average, they would exchange upwards of 50 text messages and speak for roughly an hour by phone. These two ladies are at each other's hip constantly, 24/7.
Police obtained the texts and read the communications. They were surprised at what the text messages revealed. The texts were damning.
Both of them despised Randy. Vile names being used.
The hateful comments about Randy Baker were shocking, and the two women made it clear that they desperately wanted him gone.
They frequently told one another that they loved each other. They loved one another like they would a sister, and looked forward to a time when Randy was out of their life.
The phone records revealed Kelly Baker as the mastermind of a deadly plot, who convinced Carol to find a hitman willing to execute it.
Kelly was plotting with Carol to kill Randy, and Carol and Kelly had settled on using Kelly Raisley to kill Randy.
Carol's son had a criminal history that indicated he could do the job. Assistant DA Rob Miller.
Kelly Raisley, a 211 gang member who has attempted murder charges in his history and has been in and out of prison his whole life.
The phone records also showed that Carol and her son Kelly began communicating on a separate line the day before Randy's murder.
I noticed that she began interacting with a new number that just pops up in her records from the night of the 14th into the 15th of August. And the person paying the bill for those phone records turned out to be Kelly Raisley's girlfriend. So what I'm seeing is a criminal picked up a drop phone to use. We began to call it his murder phone. The phone just used just for the purposes of the murder, and then he got rid of it.
It was all starting to add up. Investigators also discovered a motive for the crime.
life insurance policies were recovered. Four different policies were located.
And Randy Baker's estranged wife was the sole beneficiary. All the hate was really just about money. In total, Kelly Baker would inherit assets worth almost $500,000, more than enough to pay off her accomplices.
Basically, when you put it all together, you have a map for a conspiracy to commit murder.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. Investigators needed more than a roadmap to convict everyone involved. They came up with an intricate plan. Detective Michael Prill.
I wanted to try calling Randy's wife, asking if she'd be willing to come to the police department to look at some pictures, to implicate a drug dealer that I knew had nothing to do with this murder.
Police asked Randy's wife if she had ever seen the drug dealer before. They believed that she would intentionally misdirect the investigation by identifying someone who had nothing to do with the murder.
I sat down with Kelly, explained that I need to be able to verify who this drug dealer is, and so I gave her this photo array that I'd created.
Do you identify someone in there?
Yes.
How confident are you that the individual you're picking is?
100%.
And it's number two?
Yes. Detectives told Randy's wife she had just pointed out the man they believed Carol had seen lurking outside Randy's home on the night of the murder.
I explained to Kelly that Carol alleges she saw some character in the neighborhood, and I have reason to believe that was the drug dealer that Kelly just identified. And we specifically told Kelly, please don't let Carol know what picture you've picked.
Detective Prill was certain Kelly would take advantage of the situation and tell Carol who to identify. And he was right.
Within a minute, Carol Baker calls us. So, obviously, Kelly Baker called to tell her what picture to pick in the photo array.
Police asked Carol to come in to view potential suspects.
And so, as Carol agrees to come to the police department, I created a different photo array.
And the change in the photo lineup was a big one. Detective Prill replaced the man Randy's wife identified with a picture of Carol's son, Kelly Raisley.
I explained that we've got a lead on the suspect in the murder of Randy. I slide this new array in front of her.
Couldn't have a seat. Want to see if you recognize anyone in this array.
She's now looking at the same position Kelly Baker told her to pick, but it's her son, Kelly Raisley, in that position.
Her reaction to seeing a picture of her own son in the lineup spoke volumes.
She was awestruck. And it was clear she began to suspect that Kelly Baker had set her up and was framing her for this murder.
Detective Prill's ruse worked even better than he had hoped. Carol Baker, Randy's sister, immediately began to give him a full confession.
She admitted that Kelly Baker wanted to have Randy murdered.
Carol admitted that she had asked her oldest child to be the hitman. It was a sick twist to an already deplorable plot. A mother asking her own son to kill his uncle. Assistant DA Rob Miller.
For Carol to offer him up to murder her brother is just unfathomable.
Who was with Kelly in the house when he murdered her?
Nobody was there.
Just Kelly.
It had to be just Kelly.
But after Carol explained that her son Kelly was the killer, it was as though she realized she had been tricked.
When did you learn that they were going to shoot him?
I didn't learn that. I didn't know how.
Okay.
I think I need an attorney.
Okay. Well, you're under arrest for first-degree murder and conspiracy to first-degree murder. Thanks for your time.
Shortly after Carol Baker was arrested, police took Randy's wife, Kelly, into custody.
We made sure to walk them past one another so they could see somebody snitched. So now these two best friends are pitted against each other.
Police confronted Kelly with the new details Carol provided. Not surprisingly, she denied it all.
She just said, but I didn't do it. And she asked for an attorney.
The third member of the conspiracy, Carol's son, Kelly Raisley, was apprehended in Denver, and his confession added more sordid information to the murder plot. He admitted that his original plan was to give his uncle an overdose of his own heart medication.
I had some pills crushed up in my pocket. I'm not going to do a toxicology looking for it because he's already on it.
Carol Baker, who had access to her brother's home, let her son in on the night of the murder. As Kelly Raisley considered how to execute his plan, Randy actually surprised him by arriving home earlier than expected.
He caught motion out of the corner of his eye, spun around and saw that Randy had just walked into the house. He drew his .22 and shot Randy behind the ear. Randy collapsed to the ground. When Raisley noticed Randy was still breathing, he drew his larger .45 and shot him in the back. That coup de grace killed Randy instantly.
Raisley's story explained the final mystery of the investigation. It turned out that two different pistols had been used by a single gunman.
He basically said that's how he rolls. He always has a backup gun. And so in this instance, he brought his two firearms. You know, that's just how he operates or how his brain comes up with plans.
And after the rushed shooting, Raisley wasn't sure what to do next.
Raisley said he called his mom, told his mom it's done.
Raisley was stunned by his mother's reaction. She acted like the murder had been all his idea.
He was enraged with Carol's sickening response, like, oh my God, I can't believe you did it. And Raisley said he was incensed with the tone of his mother's voice, making him out to be a monster for doing what they asked him to do.
Sensing that Carol and Kelly were setting him up to be the fall guy, Raisley decided to link his mother directly to the crime, driving Randy's stolen car to her house.
He took the G6, the Pontiac, and dropped it off just to get her dirty, just to basically say, here, you're going to be part of this. Get rid of the car. So now he's leaving his mom as a 68, 69-year-old woman, finding a way to get rid of a dead man's car. So she dumped it off on her nephew, Mark Raisley.
All of the pieces of the puzzle had come together for detectives. They let Randy's family know what they had learned. Randy's ex-wife, Dory Baker.
When I found out that it was all three of them, I was blown away. Many, many, many tears. For one, I knew Kelly Raisley as a little boy. He was adorable. And it broke my heart to know that he did that. That he was part of it.
Randy's sister Carol pled guilty to second-degree murder and was sentenced to 30 years in prison. Her son, Kelly Raisley, pled guilty to first-degree murder and was given a life sentence. But Randy's wife Kelly was the only one who refused to admit guilt. She continued to insist that she played no part in her husband's murder.
Kelly Baker was the brains behind this whole operation, but one concern we had was she didn't pull the trigger.
In the end, the actual trigger man, Kelly Raisley, agreed to testify against the woman who had paid him $10,000 to commit a crime he now deeply regretted.
Kelly Raisley, the hardened criminal gangster, showed more remorse than anyone else.
He wanted to essentially clear his uncle's legacy and make sure that everyone understood that Randy was actually a great human being.
Throughout her trial, Kelly Baker refused to acknowledge any role in the crime, but the evidence against her was overwhelming. Randy's daughter, Betty Weinick.
I got to see text messages back and forth between Kelly and Carol. It just destroyed me to see how much hatred they had towards my dad.
In 2019, the jury found Kelly Baker guilty of first-degree murder. She received a sentence of life without parole.
She never showed any remorse. Randy Baker was trying to make the world a better place. He was a loving dad, and Kelly Baker was so cold-hearted, just cared about herself.
It's a painful reality Randy Baker's loved ones will struggle with for the rest of their lives.
She could have easily divorced him, but she was selfish and she wanted to be free. Instead of divorcing a sick man and being not the victim, I think that really motivated her into finding a way she could get everything and still have people feel sorry for her.
All that Randy's loved ones want to do now is to remember the good times they had with him.
Randy was funny. I miss his humor. I miss his honesty. Just the beauty that he had within him.
My dad was a big man, super loving and gentle at the same time. You can wear your heart on your sleeve and still be strong. That's what I would love my kids to learn from him.
Mark Raisley, the young man who helped his Aunt Carol get rid of Randy Baker's car, pled guilty to being an accessory to first-degree murder. He was sentenced to 6 years of probation. Prosecutors ultimately determined that he played no role in the planning of the crime. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/paulazanofficial or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next Wednesday when we're back on the case, the podcast.